Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Are you curious about the markets of late? You know, it seems like there's just this whole mix of different news. In fact, I described it to a person earlier that had asked me, you know, what about oil prices? What about the impact of that? What about interest rates? And, you know, at the end of every day, when the market finals its final tally and we see what the final numbers are for the market, you know, it moves around during the day. We see what it is. You then have the sum net total of all the things that have gone on. That's the final reckoning. That's the final number. And it ain't over till it's over. All these different things have an impact. Well, how much does interest rates versus oil affect our economy? How about the dollar getting stronger? How about all these things? Well, they all have an impact and it all weighs on the market. So there's a lot going on. And I talk about a lot of these things. As you know, in listening to this program, I like to get some help. So it's not just me talking about it. There's some great folks out there, people that are leaders in paying attention to all this stuff. And so we like to bring them on the program. Well, today's guest is right of that ilk. Philip Van Dorn is our guest. He's an investment analyst for MarketWatch. Now, if you've never gone over to MarketWatch, you're missing out. MarketWatch.com, a lot of great articles, great commentary on a lot of interesting subjects, but a lot of financial subjects. And we're going to be talking today with Philip about the 10 biggest financial market events of the last couple of weeks. So let's do this. Let's welcome Phil to the program. Phil, how are you doing?
Great, Dave. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's good to have you on the program. I know you're a busy guy. I know you've been up and down the street, so to speak. Phil has done a lot of writing over the years. He's doing the investment analyst work for MarketWatch. He's been senior analyst for The Street and has a very interesting background as a loan operations officer, credit analyst, and has his business administration degree from Long Island University. So we're really glad to get your insight into all these things that are happening. I know we could talk for 4 or 5 hours about this. So I'm talking quickly to get it into a 30-minute show. Let's start, if you would, Phil. I'd love to get your thoughts on this surprise tsunami from the Swiss move that kind of rattled the markets. And I know it's having an impact on overseas markets as well as we've seen in the United States. So tell us a little bit about what happened and how you're seeing it play out in terms of the move made by the Swiss bank.
Well, the Swiss National Bank had pegged the country's currency, the franc, to the euro since September of 2011. In order to keep the franc from raising too quickly, in order to keep the ratio at 1.2 francs to the euro, they kept buying euros. The Swiss Central Bank kept buying securities denominated in euros, and by doing this, the balance sheet of the central bank got to be almost as big as the company's gross domestic product.
Wow.
There's been a lot of complaints about the U.S.
Sure.
The Federal Reserve's balance sheet expanding, but it's nowhere near as big as our $17 or $18 annual gross domestic product. So it got to the point where the Swiss bank couldn't do it any longer, so they stopped doing it, and this caused the franc to shoot up tremendously last week, which, of course, also affected the exchange between dollars and euros and push the dollar up higher. So for Swiss stocks, it was a bad week because it instantly made the price of exports so much higher.
Wow.
And now, yesterday or today, someone from the Swiss National Bank said they may still intervene in order to keep the franc from getting too high. So we'll see what happens. But we are living in an age of great manipulation.
Yes.
We've had the huge quantitative easing, which has ended in the United States, although the Federal Reserve still has a huge balance sheet. We've had the short-term federal funds rate fixed in a range of 0 to 0.25% since late 2008. So you're earning nothing on your savings. And now everyone's anticipating that short-term rates will begin to rise, but long-term rates have gone down tremendously this year as the dollar has risen. So the drop of oil keeps our rates low. The drop of the euro keeps our interest rates low as more and more investors realize that the dollar really is the safe haven. You can expect this type of surprise to continue. Now the European Central Bank is set to start its own quantitative easing. So
everybody gets a turn at the well.
The manipulation will continue and the shocks will continue.
Yeah, everybody gets a turn at the quantitative easing well. It's interesting what you said, Philip, about the Swiss bank. That's their central bank and their move because they basically ran out of capacity to continue to buy the euro and to hold their franc from getting too to inflating too much and becoming too strong, as you alluded to, because that hurts their exports. And what's really interesting about that is that that move, you know, some thought it was a calculated thing, but they basically ran out of gunpowder and they needed to kind of shift gears. And like a tsunami, the epicenter may be halfway around the world, but here we are being affected in the United States. It actually, ironically, because I think it is ironic, made the dollar stronger against the euro. It is really, you know, there's been so many things said about our having this true global economy, but good grief. I mean, a move halfway around the world causing this more than a ripple effect. It's just really extraordinary to me how this all is so interconnected.
But it's a small world. And at the same time, you have a unified currency in Europe where the individual countries still have different policies, practices, and cultures.
Yeah.
So now some of the southern European countries, like Italy, Portugal, and Greece, are unable to do what they traditionally did when they had problems, which was to allow the value of their currency to decline. They have lost that tool.
So they're getting
now
squeezed.
Now, in order to meet the conditions being pushed by Germany, which dominates the Eurozone,
right,
the Greeks are forced to continue tightening their belts and watch their unemployment continue to rise. So ultimately, it really does look like the Eurozone could reach a breaking point, because unless they have tighter political union, which
right,
may not be so likely in an age of seemingly rising nationalist sentiment.
So here's my question then, Phil, and I know that anytime this is mentioned, you know, the next word out of people's mouths is how cataclysmic it would be, but my question is, if you have these competing national interests or rising nationalism in some of these countries that are part of the Eurozone or who are on the Euro currency, is it feasible, is it realistic to think that some countries may go back to their national currencies and give up the euro as a common currency, maybe by still being part of the union, but coming off of the euro currency itself?
Of course, it's conceivable. If you take a longer-term view, this type of upheaval has happened many times over the last 100 years. And even though we're in this period where the European technocrats have worked so hard to gain some stability, the mechanisms are there. Greece could leave the euro.
Okay.
One of my colleagues, William Watts, wrote up a scenario about how this could take place last week. The article's called "Here's One Roadmap for a Greek Eurozone Exit." So yes, it could happen, and yes, it would be painful, but it would eventually enable certain countries to regain critical policy tools.
Yeah, because it's a race to the bottom with the pricing of currencies. It's always been that way, and some of these countries, with the aspirations or promises of the greater union and all the good things that can come from the one currency, they've given up that option of devaluing, and it could really, it takes away that policy tool, as you said. Phil Van Dorn is our guest today, ladies and gentlemen, investment analyst for MarketWatch, marketwatch.com. We'll have a quick break and continue our conversation.
What if in the time it takes to eat lunch, you could potentially strengthen your financial future? Would you invest 1 hour to plan stronger? If you spend just 1 hour with certified financial planner David Holland, you'll get simple, straightforward advice to help you plan stronger. And if you already have a financial plan, isn't it worth an hour to get a second opinion? There is no cost or obligation to meet with David. Call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com for more information. Have you considered an annuity as part of your retirement plan? Did you know that over the past 10 years, Americans put a staggering $2.3 trillion into annuities? Despite their popularity, many people are unsure about annuities. Why? Because annuities have been attacked for decades by financial folks who offer competing products or services. A lot of money is at stake. So you can imagine that financial firms who only offer investments don't want you to consider an annuity. Get the facts. Call Holland Financial to get your free copy of Annuities as Part of Your Retirement Plan. This booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities, as well as straightforward information about their costs, features, safety, and income potential. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Philip Van Dorn is on the line with me, investment analyst for MarketWatch, marketwatch.com. Go take a look. A lot of good articles and information, including Philip's great work over there. Recent articles he's written really are right on the money, very insightful and interesting, and we're getting them live and getting opportunity to talk with them about some of the biggest things affecting the market of late. And you've wondered and scratched your head about some of the impact of these things, and we're kind of peeling the onion to get into it. And I wanted to go, if we could, Philip, to another subject you briefly mentioned earlier, which I know is in your top 10. Of course, is everybody knows it's been going on, but I'd be real curious about your take, and that is with oil stocks and, of course, this precipitous drop in oil prices. And it seems like every time I read the paper or turn on the news, I see another member of OPEC saying, well, heck, we can handle this at $10 or $25 or like this. They all keep wanting to say how low they can go as if it's some sort of, who can be the cheapest contest or who's willing to last longer out in the cold. What do you think?
Well, it's hard to know what to think. We had a nice little bump at the end of last week, and now West Texas crude is trading below $47. So over the short haul, the oil stocks don't look good because domestic production, which has been focused on shale production,
right,
is expensive, and it's really hard to turn a profit at these prices.
Yeah.
So we did put up a story last week talking about costs for various fracking companies in various basins in the company, and that was quite a bit of an eye-opener because there's quite a bit of difference in the cost of opening a new well via hydraulic fracturing. You have to keep opening new wells because you can't just keep tapping them forever. So we have recently looked at companies with strong balance sheets, which are better prepared to get through a year of really low oil prices. We've also looked at the ones with the lower prices for starting a fracking oil well. And we also discussed how a lot of analysts are pegging their earnings estimates for domestic oil companies on a $75 target price for oil this year.
Interesting.
Now, there are going to be production cuts, although it still seems likely that U.S. 2015 production will be higher than it was last year because of the momentum that was in place. But with the cuts, 2016 production can be expected to be lower than this year, and the price should recover a bit. I don't know how much it will recover, but I do know that only one analyst that we saw was basing his earnings estimates on the current price,
right,
rather than on the $75 price that Wall Street has been looking at.
Interesting. Well, this kind of plays into another one of your top 10s, and that is this trying to make money on what we call quote-unquote despised stocks. Some of these, and I routinely, just out of curiosity, go in and take a look at what kind of impact this is having on the stock price of some of the big energy and oil companies, and of course, naturally looking at that, what that does to their dividends and their yield at the current prices. And, I tell you, Phil, they don't look so bad. I definitely, if I were going to be buying some individual stocks, it wouldn't be such a bad thing. Pick up one that you think has a strong enough balance sheet to weather the storm, if you will, and kind of capture that better potential dividend payout vis-a-vis the yield.
Yeah. Brett Aaron wrote about the hated stocks last week and how over the last 7 years, if at the beginning of each year, you took the 10 S&P 500 stocks with the lowest recommendations, with the lowest number of buy recommendations on the street and bought them, you would have outperformed the market every year.
Isn't that funny?
So today he put up the new list just this morning of 10 hated stocks your portfolio will love. And it is an interesting list. It's got a couple of oil drillers on. It has a bank stock. It has a couple of utilities, a food stock, and an insurance stock. It's worth taking a look at, and it'll be interesting to see if this trend continues.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, and of course, for our listeners, there's the old investment strategy, the dogs of the Dow. But you mentioned the bank, how they had been made the list. And I know you do watch and follow the banks. The earnings numbers weren't so hot.
No, they weren't, and the coverage focused on weak trading revenue, but the expected improvement in net interest margins has been pushed back a little bit. The drop in long-term interest rates during 2014 and now again so far this year is really hurting the banks. Mm-hmm. They already, years ago, they enjoyed the majority of the benefit from the short-term rates being close to zero.
Right.
And now, on their asset side, you know, the loans that they're making and the securities that they're buying have low rates. So for banks, it's a depressing story of trying to wring out as much expense savings as possible. And with credit quality continuing to improve over the years, banks have been able to release loan loss reserves, which boosts their earnings temporarily. But now we seem to be getting to the point where the banks will have to begin adding more to their reserves each quarter, which will hurt their earnings. So with the squeezing of the net interest margins, and the anticipated provisioning for loan losses, we can expect the overall earnings weakness to continue. I can't speak for the trading revenue because it fluctuates tremendously.
Sure.
But for the basic banking side of it, you're in a bit of a rough spot. Among the biggest banks, I continue to love Discover Financial because they always put up fantastic numbers. As a nearly pure credit card play, you're getting returns on equity well in excess of 20% year after year, and the bank does not have a target on its back the way J.P. Morgan Chase does. So they're always outperforming almost every other bank. So that is one that everyone should look at, especially since the price-to-earnings ratio is quite low. And then if you're looking for the biggest banks, Wells Fargo seems to be the one that's best positioned. It will not have to hold as much extra capital as J.P. Morgan will.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have the same political target on its back. It has a nice diversity of revenue between net interest income and fee income, and it also is well positioned for fees on mortgage lending, which with mortgage applications rising as rates decline.
Strong argument for diversification, I will not argue with that at all, Philip. That's smart. Well, and on the related subject of some of these banks, I guess kind of we talked about how some of the opportunities might lie with some of the stocks that have been beaten up. How about over on the other side? What about some of the warnings about overvaluation of stocks in general?
Well, the S&P 500 is trading for about 14.5 times the aggregate consensus earnings estimates for 2016.
Okay.
So we go out an extra year when we look at forward price to earnings ratios.
Right.
Now, the forward PE for the index hasn't been this high since 2005, when it was a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, this morning, I looked back at all those years. So it was about 14.9 times exactly 10 years ago. So that could be an alarming sign. And Mark Holbrook, who's one of our most popular writers, wrote a technical piece saying that the stock market is overvalued any way you look at it. But he said it was this way a year ago as well. These measures can be alarming, but they don't tell us what's going to happen over the short term. So we had another technical analyst, a gentleman named L.A. Little, who said last week that it's been this way for 5 years. He has no idea when it's going to happen, but eventually you'll see a 10 or 20% correction and all the headlines that go with it. And as a long-term investor, I couldn't care less. It depends what your investment objectives are. If you're like so many millions of people contributed, making regular contributions to an employee-sponsored tax-deferred retirement plan, and you still have many years to go, a crash is a good thing. Your next investment goes in at a lower price.
Amen. But if you're 1 year away from retirement and you are going to need to reposition, well, maybe now is the time to reevaluate and maybe take stock, no pun intended, in where the market is and what's happening with valuations.
Maybe you should have already begun somewhat of a shift in your portfolio to make it a bit more conservative. And of course, you will need to consider your whole objective when you retire. I believe the objective should be income. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the objective should be building up a nest egg that's so big you can't spend it all. I think you have to generate sufficient income to go on living forever. That is the responsible way to prepare for retirement.
And Phil has just stolen from my playbook. That's exactly what it's all about, Phil. I couldn't agree more. Philip Van Dorn is our guest, investment analyst for MarketWatch. MarketWatch.com. And we'll grab a break and we'll be right back. I want to ask Philip about a couple of individual stocks that we've been keeping our eye on. Stay right there.
Do you know how to get the most from Social Security? Don't let a simple mistake prevent you from receiving all the benefits you've earned. David Holland recently showed a retiring couple how they could get an extra $84,000 in Social Security benefits over their expected lifetime. Wow! Don't leave your money on the table. Call Holland Financial today for your one-on-one appointment. David can do a free analysis for you and show you the optimal age to start drawing Social Security and filing techniques to maximize your benefits. There is no cost or obligation. Call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Insightful analyst and analysis from investment analyst for MarketWatch, Philip Van Dorn. Glad to have him on the program, MarketWatch.com. Good stuff there. So I want to go to a couple individual stocks that we could, Phil. One caught the news or caught my attention in the news about Google. There's been a lot going on with Google. Of course, they're a huge company. They are into a lot of things. And I saw that they recently made an investment in SpaceX. So now they're looking to get involved with, it sounded like the motivation was involved with satellites and things of that nature. What's your take and what are you seeing with Google?
With SpaceX, the idea is to invest in a new system to provide internet coverage via satellite.
Wow.
In remote corners of the globe. That'll be interesting.
Yeah.
You know, satellite communication has not always been a winner, but it'll be interesting to see how they do with it. So for Google, Google is still very much a play on innovation. Their revenue grew by 20% last year, although their net income declined by 1%, and their earnings per share were flat. So some investors were probably frustrated with the stock last year. Right now, it's trading for 14.6 times forward earnings. So Google, there are arguments on how worthwhile the stock is right
sure.
now.
At current
and
valuations, yeah.
It was down 5% last year, and this year it's down 4%. So the company is obviously a long-term winner. They've been really good at everything that they've done. They're being targeted politically, especially in Europe. And my colleague and friend Jeff Reeves wrote a story last week about Google's valuation. He thinks that a lot of investors have it wrong. He said the valuation is, at worst, fair. So if the valuation is fair, I don't know how interesting the stock is, but the company sure is fair.
That's a great way to put it. I was just thinking that myself. You can't talk about Google without talking about Apple, right? Isn't that the deal, Philip? So what's been happening with Apple of late that we should know about?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's fair. It's not necessarily fair to directly compare the two companies, even though
yeah.
they do compete
sure.
when it comes to smartphone hardware and software. Google has its fingers in a lot of different pots and is spending a lot of money on trying to innovate in different ways.
Yeah.
Apple is simply a beautiful stock and has turned into a company that is very friendly to shareholders. So in contrast to Google, which was down 5% last year, Apple's stock went up 41%. So far this year, it's down 5%. If you look at Apple's numbers, the stock is cheaper than Google, trading for only 12.4 times the consensus 2016 earnings estimate. So it's cheaper than Google, and it's cheaper than the whole market. For its fiscal 2014, which ended on September 27th, Apple's revenue rose 7%. Its gross margin improved slightly to 39%. Its net income rose 7%, but its earnings per share rose 14%. The earnings per share rose that much because the average share count was down 6% from the buyback. And right now their dividend is close to 1.8%, which is a little bit of icing on the cake. So the stock might be down this year because you're seeing articles saying that Apple's iPhone 6 sales are certain to drop. And it's a funny thing with Apple. No matter how well they do, you get these doubtful comments. They set the bar very high, and their quarterly sales of the iPhone 6 may not be quite as high as they are for the... They may not remain quite as high as they are for the early quarters, especially following the Christmas season. But this is an amazing company, and I don't see any reason why, with this valuation, anyone wouldn't want to consider the stock. With that being said, I'm not allowed to buy any stocks myself, so there's no conflict of interest here.
Fair enough. We will certainly take advantage of this information, though, Philip. And on another area that where there is direct comparisons and direct conversation about what each company is doing is over in the electric vehicle market. And we, of course, have Tesla out there, and they have been the subject of many commentary and many of analysts' review. And it's GM now who is making a big push. We saw this with one of their recent rollouts with what they're doing with their vehicles. So what's at stake for these companies? Obviously, GM wants to enter this market in a significant way. What's the impact potentially on Tesla?
Well, it's too early to say, but the impact will be very heavy competition at that lower level. The GM, the car, the Chevy Bolt, is going to be priced at around $30,000, and Tesla has a new model that's going to be priced at around $35,000. So they will be directly competing on price. Although Tesla's flagship model is priced at above $70,000, so that's more of a luxury car. Elon Musk has said that he believes the electric engines are simply better than the internal combustion engines, regardless of how they are powered.
Right.
They're more durable, they're more potentially more powerful, and that he thinks he's convinced the world is going to head in this direction despite what has just happened to the price.
With oil prices, yeah.
So I think GM's doing a good thing. GM also said they're going to be greatly increasing their research and development spending, but if you have a $30,000 electric car, if a particular individual can use that car to commute to work each day and not have to worry about getting the battery charged, I think you're going to have a viable consumer product. And there's no reason to believe that oil will remain this low for that many years, because it's the repeat pattern for commodities. Price goes up, production increases. Price crashes, production declines.
Write that down, ladies and gentlemen. That's exactly how it worked. And we're glad
that's
to have you,
gold,
Phil.
Also.
Yeah, that's great. That's very good. Philip Van Dorn, ladies and gentlemen, investment analyst for MarketWatch, marketwatch.com. Lots of good stuff there. Phil, we'll have you back. You're a great guest. I enjoyed having you on, and
Thanks.
It's insightful analysis, and we'll do it again.
Thank you very much, David.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.